This is Wide Margins Episode 3, Close Call, a conversation with Robbie Eversole. Robbie Eversole preaches for the Pinville Church of Christ in Somerville, Georgia, and last spring he held a meeting at the Asheville Road Church of Christ where I preach. While Robbie was with us, he was kind enough to sit down with me and have a conversation about a tragedy that struck his family not too many months before he held the meeting with us. And I'm so glad that he did, because Robbie has a very interesting story to tell, but it's also an encouragement, particularly to parents. If you're any parent with any child, it'll be helpful to you, but it will really help those parents who are struggling with their children right now, not knowing how to respond to disappointments in their children's lives, or maybe, you know, tragedy that has struck your family. I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope you will too. Here's my conversation with Robbie. So, you want to talk about your son?
I would love to talk about my son. From about the age of 14 on up through age 30, was deeply involved in drug activity. It began with him just being a user. He was a very very popular kid at school. He played football, and he also wrestled, and so he was a very good athlete, so he was very popular. He hung out with the football players. I was one of the team chaplains. And there was another team chaplain, and we shared our duties and responsibilities on the football program, as far as I would do the devotion one week and he'd do the devotion the next. And this chaplain, he would have the kids over to his house all the time. He lived only 100 yards from the football field and from the field house. So he would have the kids over, and he got them started on drugs.
The chaplain did.
The chaplain did, yes.
Now, this guy, what did he do for a living? He a preacher?
He was a preacher. He preached for the Baptist Church, one of the local Baptist churches in town. And he was disabled, He stayed home all the time, but would preach on Sundays. Mm-hmm. And his wife worked and earned a living other than what his salary was at church. I don't know.
Right, I was just, you know, some people, volunteers, chaplains, and they have other walks in life. And I'm trying to put together this whole concept of a guy who's a preacher and a chaplain getting kids hooked on drugs.
He also taught the kids a lot of other very poor behaviors. The way he would talk to his own wife, and the names that he would call his own wife, in front, which I cannot repeat on.
Right.
What
was he? I mean, do you have any idea what his motivation
would
have been in
that? Have no clue. My son had been on drugs for about 2 or 3 years before I found all this out. It came out later. And uh-huh. Some of the, I was talking just 3 months ago to one of the kids now that is a teacher at the school. He was on the football team with my son. And I cornered him, and he admitted everything. He said, yes, that mm-hmm. this Baptist preacher had given all of them drugs and beer and got them started on. I think what it was actually was this preacher wanted to be one of them. He wanted to fit in and be popular. Mm-hmm. He cared more about being one of them than he did be an example mm-hmm. to all of them. Yeah. And anyway, he got my son started on drugs, and we had a 16-year battle from about age 14 to age 30. And he had some periods of time when he would be clean, We got him into, he got kicked out of the school there in Georgia. We got him into a school over in here in Alabama. And that was very, very good for him.
And a public school?
It was a public school. Yeah. Yes.
Different environment though, different away environment. away from the associations.
Away from that it's that backward pull of that old environment that hits you. Yeah. You can't make a clean break in life and keep the same friends.
Yeah.
And there has to be a change in associations for there to be a change in your life. You can't still run with the riffraff of the world and not expect to be still affected by that and still the peer pressure of making poor choices. So we got him into a school over here in Alabama. He was clean. He met a girl. They dated their junior and senior year. They wanted to get married, but they wanted to have their education behind them. My son had offers for football from Alabama, Kentucky, Kansas. He's a very good football player. Had other schools that looked at him that did not offer. But he wanted to do a two-year program so that they could get married. And so he moved to Nashville, began a surgical tech program. She moved to South Alabama to begin a two-year nursing program. And after he was in Nashville for 3 months, she called him and told him she'd found another. So he went right back on the drugs, got into a gang. I had some trouble leaving that gang. They threatened to kill him. The gang did. But he got out of that and moved to another state, to the state of Tennessee, and cleaned up again for a little while. He had 1 8-year period where he didn't do anything. And then he met
And you, as a parent, you think we've got this beat.
We got
it's
it beat.
Behind
yeah,
us.
Yeah, yeah. When you go that long, when you
that's a long time.
That is a long time. And you'd think you've got it beat. But then he met a girl. And this girl was, he met her in a bar room. And that's not the right place to meet someone that you want to maybe look at to settle down with for life. Yeah. I'm not saying, and please don't misunderstand me, I'm not saying that that everybody that would visit an establishment like that is a horrible person. I'm not suggesting that at all. But I am suggesting that this particular person was a horrible person. But now, she didn't do anything to my son that he didn't allow her to do. He made personal choices, as we all do. Now, her history was she had been a drug dealer. Her grandparents, even her great-grandparents, going back for nearly 100 years, that family had a really bad reputation of even murder and drug dealing. And the feds were watching her really, really close.
Wow.
So, as a matter of fact, the DEA was following her and filming her and her drug deals. Well, when my son met her, and his name is Robbie, when my son met her, he graduated from not just being a user of the product, but he began helping her sell and move the product.
Right.
So
that's a whole nother level, not just socially and personally, but legally.
Yeah.
It's a whole nother level right there.
Yeah. And you look at the progressive nature of sin. Blessed is the man that walks not in the counsel, stands not in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. You have walking, standing, sitting. You see in Psalm 1, verse 1, you see the progressive nature of
getting
sin.
More and more comfortable.
You do. You become more and more desensitized.
Yeah, that's probably a better word, because it's not comfortable at all once you get
a certain
into those levels.
Nothing matters anymore except that next fix, that next hit. Well, one of his so-called drug friends, March of 2016, had knocked the window out of his truck, stole about $8,000 or $9,000, maybe $10,000, which was drug money.
Yeah.
And about $8,000 or $10,000 worth of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And my son knew who it was. And so he gets a ball bat and he goes to excise a little bit of justice.
Mm-hmm.
And he kicks the guy's door and they were waiting on him. They knew he was coming. And so they had all the lights out. It was at like 11 at night. And so they were waiting. And as soon as his foot hit the door, they shot him. And that began another nightmare.
Mm.
But I'll tell you, I'm so thankful for that bullet.
Yeah.
Because of where my son is today compared to where he was then.
Yeah.
They shot his major vessel. You have two major vessels that drop down from your aorta in your abdomen. And they shot one of those in two. His girlfriend was there and two other druggies were there with him. And so they threw him in his pickup truck, drove him over to a fire hall, dialed 911, and they fled because they were afraid they would be arrested.
Yeah.
And from a parent's standpoint, as I look back as a daddy, I mean, it's terrifying as to what could have happened.
Mm-hmm.
He was laying there with his aorta blown up, gushing blood. And he said he could hear the siren in the distance.
Mm-hmm.
He was going in and out then. And he was in shock by the time they got him to the hospital. They kept on the ride. They kept shaking him. Wake up, stay with us. Wake up, stay with us. Well, he got to the hospital about midnight. And we sat in a little room. The little room that they put you in when they're expecting to give you bad news. We weren't in a regular waiting room. We were in a little
more private.
Yeah. Little private room.
You don't want to be in that room.
Don't. That's a room you do not.
As a preacher, you've seen others in that room.
Been there many, many times. So we sat there from 14 and a half hours till 2:30 the next day. The nurse would come by every once in a while and stick her head in the room and she'd say, "They're still in surgery. They're still in surgery. They're still in surgery." At 2:30, from midnight Monday night to 2:30 Tuesday afternoon, the doctor stepped into the room and asked if he could sit down. And of course, we let him sit down. And he said, "Well, he's alive." Said he shouldn't be. Said he shouldn't have been alive to get to the hospital. He should have died en route. Said he shouldn't have lived through surgery. Said we've given him a ton of blood, not only blood, but blood products.
Mm.
And I'm not sure what all that entails, blood products. But it was plasma, platelets, clotting agents. He said a ton. Said we just now got the bleeding stopped, 14 and a half hours. And said we've left him open. We got to go in. His bowels were shot in two. The bullet tumbled, made an exit wound. He had a grievous wound.
Mm.
And I asked the doc, I said, "Is he going to live?" And he said, "No, can't live with a wound like that." And of course,
just matter of fact, like that.
Just
he didn't
fact.
Sneak up on it. He just.
He said he can't live.
Just said no.
He said, if by chance he were to live, he will be here several months, and he will have many surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we've left him open, just put some kind of a bandage on it, but they didn't sew him. They never did sew him. They just clamped him, stapled him. But he said, we've left him open, and we got to go in the morning. And reattach his bowels, excise, cut away some of the bowel, and he said it's a mess in there. So he said, but it'll be a 2-hour procedure. We got the OR for 2 hours. Then at 10 till 8 the next morning. Oh, by the way, he said he's in the trauma ICU and he's on life support. 10 to 8 the next morning, Wednesday morning, I was in the waiting room and the phone rang and they said, the nurse said, since we didn't have to open him up, he was already open. She said, we're already down below where we would normally be. It's like we got a head start.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, it's a 2-hour procedure. You'll hear from us in 2 hours. So 10 to 8, I figured 10 to 10. 10 mm-hmm. o'clock. 10 o'clock came, 11, 12, 1, 2, no word.
Mm.
I'd already...
No updates or anything. No updates.
The phone never rang. Mm. I'd already made... This is not my first rodeo. I've sat at hospitals with hundreds of families through the last 30 years as a minister of the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd already made up my mind, or it was in my mind, that he passed, and they're going to clean him up
mm-hmm.
and maybe call the coroner down or something, and mm-hmm. they'll get us back to see him.
It's rarely a good sign
that
it takes longer, because they know especially, they know their business.
Especially they, 4.5 hours.
Yeah.
And to have no update.
Right. Because they'll call the waiting room sometimes and say, just giving you an update, everything's going
never
as well.
They called at 10 to 8 when they started,
mm-hmm.
and that was the only call. 2:30, the doctor stepped into the room, million-dollar smile, and said, well, we closed him up. Said,
he's as surprised as you are.
He said, we closed him up, no more surgeries. Said, he's back in the trauma ICU. He's back on life support. Said, he'll probably be there for a couple of weeks at least till they can wean him off life support, because he's not doing nothing on his own.
Mm-hmm.
And that was on Wednesday. So I stood up and I looked the doctor eyeball to eyeball. I said, is my son going to live? And he paused for a moment and he said, you know, he might. Probably not, but he might. He's young and he's strong.
Was this the same guy that said he didn't have a chance?
Yes, the same doctor.
The night before.
Yeah, the night before.
So he's come.
He said, no way, he can live. He said, but if he does live, he will be here several months, and he'll be in the intensive care unit a couple of weeks. That was Wednesday. On Thursday, the next day, they removed the life support.
Mm.
On Friday, he went out of the ICU into a room on the regular floor, a regular room on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And he continued to where they were able to take a lot of the tubes and stuff out once he got to the regular floor.
Mm-hmm.
And because he is breathing on his own. And they came in Tuesday morning. Now, he was shot Monday night. The next Tuesday morning would have been 8 days.
Okay.
Tuesday to Tuesday, 8 days. And they came in that Tuesday morning about 5 o'clock. 5 surgeons, 4 males and a female. And they had been the team that had operated on him the night that he was brought to the emergency room shot.
Mm-hmm.
They all came in together as a team, removed his dressing, squeezed around. They were looking for infections.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the gentlemen said, you know, we might be able to release him to a wound care facility either tomorrow, which would have been Wednesday, or Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
Said, for a couple of weeks. They came in, the same team, 4 men, 1 woman.
Mm-hmm.
They came in the very next morning, Wednesday morning, removed his dressing, and they got over in the corner and had a little powwow, whispering among themselves, and he turned around, I guess he was the lead surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
He turned around and said he can go home. Said he don't need wound care.
Wow.
Said we're releasing him today.
No infection.
No infection. No problem. Prayer, brother. Prayer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people. I've been doing this for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've preached in several, almost all over the United States. And I've been on TV a lot. And I've preached in 3 different continents. I just know a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was getting messages from every continent except Asia and Antarctica, Australia, New Zealand, Africa, Europe, South America, North America, every continent except Asia and Antarctica.
Mm.
And nobody lives in Antarctica.
Right, yeah.
But anyway, the power of prayer. Uh-huh. I know why my son lived. The doctor said he should not have lived to even gotten to the hospital. You just don't live with your aorta shot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not a miracle. God doesn't work miraculously today. God works providentially.
Mm-hmm.
And God has the power to make things happen, or else prayer would be worthless or meaningless.
Yes. Yeah, and just to be clear to some of our listeners, you just threw something out there that a lot of us have heard all our lives, but some of our listeners probably were pretty surprised by what you just said, either because they're on one side of the spectrum where they don't believe God is active at all, or they're on the other side of the spectrum that believes that God can only act through miracles. So you drew a distinction between miracles and providence. The way I take it is that providence is God working, but he's working through the natural laws. He's working through the creation that he made, the intended organization, the cosmos, however you want to put it. And miracles is when he supersedes that. And it's strictly supernatural activity, if you want to use the term in its biblical meaning. Whenever you read about a miracle or a sign or a wonder in the Bible, it's, you know, we're taking 5 loaves and 2 fish and feeding 10,000 people, not, you know, having a baby or something.
Yes.
And
yeah, and people,
so that's what you mean. He's active.
God
he's
is,
using his world
God
to act.
Uses providence today. He works providentially. But to say that he's not working miraculously is not to say that he's not working at all.
Yes, yeah, that's what I wanted to make sure everybody understood.
A miracle is the suspension of natural law.
Mm-hmm.
When Jesus walked on the water, the natural law of gravity, it's gravity that pulls you under the water.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't for gravity, all of us could walk on the water.
Yeah.
But the natural law of gravity was suspended for him at that particular time and was for Peter for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
But then gravity kicked back in when Peter saw perhaps the wind and the waves, and he took his eyes off of Jesus, and gravity began to pull him under again. So God was working providentially. And my son was raised from the time, well, the first Sunday we brought him home from the hospital, he was in the assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't a minister at that time, and we never missed. He was always Wednesday night, Sunday night, Sunday morning, gospel meeting, vacation Bible school, because all those things were important.
Mm-hmm.
And we were always in attendance. And then especially, he was 2 years old when I began my time at the School of Preaching in Karnes, Tennessee. Especially from then on, I was always preaching, so he was always there.
Mm-hmm.
He came up in a program called Lads to Leaders.
Mm-hmm.
He did talks. He led singing. He was very, very actively involved in all of the works that we are involved in the Lord's church. But when he met this Baptist preacher at the age of 14, one of the things that parents may need to sort of cue in on, that may be afraid that one of their children is, are they a follower or are they a leader? My son was a follower.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter was a leader, and to this day, and to this very day, she's 32 years old, and she has never tasted what alcohol tastes like. unless she had it in NyQuil or something like mm-hmm. that. We were talking the other day, and she said, Daddy, I've never tasted alcohol. Though I had all of my friends during school,
mm-hmm.
and she said, I just told them you're stupid for doing that.
Mm-hmm. But she didn't need it. She didn't need the popularity if it wasn't going to serve her principles.
Did not need mm-hmm. it. Didn't care in it. And she's that way today.
Mm-hmm.
You either accept her the way she is or you take
yeah.
a hike.
Yeah.
You know, she's not going to bend her convictions to try to get you to like her.
Mm-hmm. Your son fed on
popularity.
The popularity. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And he wanted to see, he started for the varsity when he was in ninth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And usually you're 10th or 11th yeah. grade before you play varsity football.
Right.
He was
yeah.
the number one D lineman. And
I didn't get to play varsity till I was a senior, and it was out of sympathy that I got to play senior year.
He played as a freshman
yeah.
in varsity.
Wow.
So he was very popular. All the kids were always hanging around him,
mm-hmm.
and he fed on that, and he needed that. So when he was a freshman and hanging out with the seniors at this preacher's house, they were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So he did it too.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a child that's a follower, that's a cue to make sure you pay a little bit of extra attention.
Mm-hmm.
to them, because I was blindsided. I had no clue
mm-hmm.
that my son was on any type of anything.
Well, that's one of the reasons I wanted people to hear your story, because I think there's a lot of parents out there beating themselves up. It's my fault. I'm not a perfect parent. There aren't perfect parents, and there aren't perfect kids, and you can do I start to say everything right, but you can do most things right and still have tragedy and trials. There are a lot of variables involved in raising a child and just in life in general. And sometimes parents are to blame, and sometimes it's a combination of things, and sometimes the parents didn't do anything wrong. It just, kids make choices too.
Yeah. I liken it to we can fool God. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. We
Whoops.
Cannot fool
yeah.
God,
yeah.
but we can fool others
mm-hmm.
to make them think that we are some great Christian and we're some...
Yeah.
There's no fooling God.
Yeah.
But if I make a poor choice, it's not God's fault.
That's right.
Yeah. And if our kids make a poor choice...
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
I know where you're going, yeah.
Yeah. It's not always. Mm-hmm. Now, God is a perfect father, and I'm not. And so
right.
I do make mistakes.
Yeah.
Or I did make my mistakes as a parent. My kids are grown and gone now. But I made my share of mistakes. And I have repented of those, and mm-hmm. I've asked God to forgive me for those. I was doing the best I could do,
mm-hmm.
but sometimes our best, at the best we can do, our kids still make their own personal choices.
Yeah.
And it's the pull, the magnetism of this old world.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't think temptation is strong,
right,
then we might be the problem.
Yeah.
And we need to guard our kids. We need to parent with authority. We need to parent and be the kind of parent that's actively involved
yeah.
in your kid's life.
And discerning.
You
know, what you explained a while ago, I've never heard that before. To watch your kids and their personality types and alter your methods accordingly. Because all kids... When Julie and I were thinking about adoption, we were talking about, you know, the differences between adoption and biological children, and we thought, you know, nature versus nurture and all this. And we started thinking about friends of ours that have multiple biological children and how different the children were from one another. And we thought, it doesn't matter if you adopt or if you have biological children, every kid is going to be different. And so I've thought about that before, but the idea that you watch that and you look for that, in particular, the leadership and the follower, and you adjust accordingly, that's great advice. That makes perfect sense to me.
Because no two kids are the same.
Now, would you say that you learned that the hard way?
I learned that the hard way.
Yeah, you're doing this in hindsight.
I had total confidence, too much confidence, and too much trust. Mm-hmm. Not only in my son, but in his associates.
Yeah.
And don't give your children a rope to hang themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Be actively involved. Know their friends. Know where they are. And dads and moms, it's your job to snoop. I'll just go ahead.
And it's not your job to be liked or to be popular.
You're not. Yeah. You're not to be your kid's best friend.
Yeah.
No. It's your job to snoop. Mm-hmm. Trust, but verify.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Trust, but verify. Mm-hmm. And let them know, look, I'm watching you like a hawk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's all right, too.
Yeah.
Because you love your child. You've got their best interest at heart.
Mm-hmm.
I jokingly, of course, after my son was shot and he got to come home on that Wednesday, and we knew then he was going to live.
Mm-hmm.
On the previous Wednesday night, while he was still in the trauma intensive care on life support, of course, he had a big tube up each nostril and had a big tube that's probably at least an inch in diameter down his throat, and the machine would make a noise and his chest would rise and fall. And so he couldn't talk. He had all these tubes. And we developed a little thing. Was one squeeze is yes and two is no.
So he was responsive.
He just didn't, sure was.
But couldn't speak.
He just couldn't speak.
Yeah.
And he would wake up and we would communicate in very archaic ways, I guess you could say. But it was still communication, and I was glad for each little bit of progress that he was making. But we had attended that Wednesday night, and it was shot on Monday night. He had surgery for 14 and a half hours, and then on Wednesday morning had the supposedly two-hour surgery. Well, that Wednesday night, we went to Bible study where your father-in-law is the minister there in Chattanooga, and we came back, and visiting hours were just about over. So slid into the room that he was in the trauma unit, and he was awake. And I said, Robbie, I'm going to go to God in prayer. I said, do you want me to ask God for the forgiveness of your past sins? And because he had been baptized as a young man, so all he needed to do was to repent and ask God for forgiveness. So he squeezed my hand once. So we did that. And he got out of the hospital the following Wednesday. Well, the following Sunday, he was at Pent, where I preach at Bethel. And he came down the aisle during the invitation, and he said, Dad, I remember what we did Wednesday night. He said, but I just want to make it public. And he's never looked back.
Yeah.
Now he's been accepted into the Memphis School of Preaching. And he's a full-time song leader where he is now.
Yeah,
he's preaching, speaking to youth groups about his.
He's already talking about this.
Yes, he's and he will be at a huge event this August, Polishing the Pulpit.
And it hasn't even been a year.
Hasn't even been a year.
Yet.
And I was joking with him, and I told him, I said, son, if I had known that getting shot would have this type of a turnaround in your life, I'd have shot you a long time ago. And of course, joking, you know,
yeah,
we can do that now. It was a lot of tears,
yeah,
a lot of heartache, a lot of dread for what the future held for him. But it's all turned out good. Look, I've never found God to be less than faithful in my life. God is always good. He always does the right thing. He always leads in the right way. And he always, always, always is faithful.
Yeah.
There's no turning. There's no shadow cast by his turning his back on us.
Yeah.
When he was shot, I never lost my faith. My prayer was, God, if you've got to take him, I'm fine with that. And I prayed this prayer. I'd rather you not take him. But if it's his time, let him have an opportunity to make it right. And I know why he lived the night he was shot and thrown in the truck. And he's there and he had his hand over it. His stomach and blood was gushing. He said, God, not now, not tonight. I'm not ready. Let me get ready. And he lived. And that's why he lived. Wow. It wasn't the doctors.
Right.
He had no doctors.
When that doctor came, when the doctor came in and told you,
said he should not have made it.
Yeah, that's the science.
Because it was a 30-mile trip from where they picked him up to the hospital.
Oh my,
30 miles. Yeah,
and losing lots of blood every minute,
gushing.
Yeah, that's the providence.
He was all providence of God. Yeah, sure is.
No doubt. Well, I really appreciate you sharing that. I know it's not easy. But I wouldn't have asked you to if I hadn't. You seem willing to share it, knowing that it helps other people. And I hope that someone's listening. I hope a lot of people are listening who are getting some encouragement from it. I know it encourages me, and I appreciate you doing this.
Appreciate the opportunity. If it can help one person, it's time well spent.